Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they've put him." So Peter and the other disciple started out for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped round Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went in. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. Now Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They've taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this, she turned round and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. He asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. That is the word of the Lord. It's a large portion of Scripture, so we're just going to walk through it this morning. We can't stop anywhere very long. But it was just before dawn when Mary Magdalene made her way to the tomb of Jesus just outside the city of Jerusalem. Other gospel writers say it was dawn, it was dark, it was just getting light. The other scriptures also said that other women were with her, and she may have been the first to arrive at the tomb because she seems to be on her own at this first instant. And it's her intention to anoint the body of Jesus as the Jewish burial process. And maybe they're thinking, because Joseph and Nicodemus rushed to get the body into the tomb before the Feast of Unleavened Bread, maybe there was further work needed to be done in preparing the body. But as she is traveling through the darkness, and the Mount of Olives is higher than the city of Jerusalem, and as the sun is coming up over the Mount of Olives, it will cast that shadow over the city still, so there would be darkness where she is. As she is traveling to the tomb outside the city wall, the only thing on her mind is that how on earth are they going to remove the large, round, mill-like stone that is blocking the tomb, that has sealed the tomb. She and everyone else had no conception that Jesus was going to rise from the dead. It never entered their head. Never entered their head. And you can see this quite clearly, because why would she go into the tomb? She was going to the tomb to apply more sweet-smelling spices in order, in her mind, to mask the stench of decaying flesh. That's why she's going. She's assuming, I've got to anoint the body. It's our way of doing things. He's been dead 3 days. I need to get into the tomb. We need to spread more spices, because in our way of doing death, we cover the body so that there is less smell, for want of a better term. She has got no mind, anything in her mind, to say that Jesus is going to rise from the dead. If Mary or other followers had thought he was going to rise, they wouldn't be rushing to the tomb, they wouldn't be carrying expensive spices, and they wouldn't risk the gauntlet of going past the Roman soldiers. They're just going to deal with the dead body. But in the dawn gloom, as she's approaching this garden tomb, she can see that the stone has been moved. Not only has it been moved, and this is a round stone, and it would have sat in a groove, it's been lifted completely out of the groove and laying on the ground. Something or someone powerful has lifted that stone out of the way. And there are no Roman guards. The Roman sentries are missing from the scene. And on seeing the tomb wide open, and with no detachment of soldiers present, Mary fears the worst. The empty tomb to Mary Magdalene was a disastrous tragedy. It was a worst case scenario. The tomb has been raided. The tomb has been robbed. This is terrible. It's a terrible few days that have just got a whole lot worse. Because the very thing she wanted to do for her Lord was to anoint his body because it would soon be decaying, and now someone has taken the body away. This is awful. An empty tomb is awful. Verse 2. So she ran as fast as she could to find Peter and John. I've often wondered, what happened to Peter after the cock crowed that third time? And he went off into the darkness, weeping bitterly. What happened to Peter? His world had come to an end when he denied his Lord. Well, we have an answer. Either Peter found John or John found Peter. But the two of them obviously found some kind of comfort and solace in each other. They were lifelong friends in that respect. And so Peter somehow had teamed up with John. But Mary ran from the tomb, ran back to Jerusalem. And she probably arrives wherever Peter and John are staying in their lodgings. She probably arrives there breathless. She's run all the way back. And she says these key words, and the key words, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him. Two words stand out there. They and we. She is assuming that the tomb has been robbed by someone, whoever the they are. And she is confirming that other women were with her. We don't know where they've taken him. Verse 3 and 4. So Peter and John drop everything. And they start running to the tomb. They leave Jerusalem. They're going through maybe the Damascus Gate. And they're running as fast as they can through to the tomb area. They are fixed on this notion that the tomb has been robbed. Something has happened. And John, maybe he's younger, maybe he's fitter, but he outruns Peter. And he gets there to the tomb first. The light has now come up over the Mount of Olives. The sunlight is now streaming. It's now day. There's now shafts of light in this early morning dawn. And verse 5, it says, on arriving at the tomb, John stoops. So the entrance is very low. John stoops to look in, but he hesitates. He does not enter. But by his looking in at a dark tomb, he can see the burial wrappings lying on the shelf where the body had laid. He doesn't enter. But it is as bad as Mary has said. It's an empty tomb. It's awful. It's terrible. It's an empty tomb. And then verse 6 and 7, the shafts of light have now come in over the Mount of Olives. And Peter's pounding footsteps can be heard coming up to the tomb. And without any hesitation, he stoops and he enters. He's still haunted by the fact, no doubt, of Friday night, Thursday night, when he had denied his Lord. The original text indicates this, that Peter just doesn't look. Peter carefully examines what's gone on. He takes in every detail. He keeps his eye on everything. And what Peter notices is that the linen burial shroud, how Jews buried people, the body, strip of linen, layer of spices, strip of linen, layer of spices, strip of linen, layer of spices. The head was treated differently. The head was wrapped, spice, wrapped, spice, wrapped, spice. The linen shrouds, linen strips, are lying perfectly where the body had laid, and the facial cloth just separate. Very fact that the cloth is separate and still folded, there is a deeper significance there as well, which we can't go into today, but that goes back to the Passover and something called the Afikomen. There was a link there into that. Verse 8 and 9, finally John stoops down and enters the tomb. He now carefully observes the scene, but Scripture goes one step further with John. It says of John that he believed. But the question is, what did he believe? What can we deduce from this scene then, forensically in that sense? Some commentators will say, and you'll read it in your books next week, that as the linen strips are laid perfectly, and then the head cloth separate where it should be, some commentators will say that when Jesus rose from the dead, he simply passed through the linen strips, just passed through them in his glorified state, leaving them in exactly the correct position, just minus the body. He passed through in glorious resurrection. Other commentators would say, well, that's stretching it a bit too far. It doesn't actually say that. It just says the linen is there. So I'll let you make your own decision. But this is a point I want to come to. However, it is crystal clear that what they saw means that the body had not been stolen. Link it through. Those wishing to steal a body, wishing to desecrate a body, wishing to disturb a body, would not neatly remove the linen strips. They would not neatly remove the head napkin. No thieves would take the body wrapped. Those desecrating would rip and tear and pull away. No one wants to carry flesh on flesh, a 3-day dead corpse. No one. As a police officer for 27 years, I have done that. No one wants to do that. And so what has happened in this tomb? Whatever happened in that tomb before dawn on Sunday morning was orderly, was precise, was unrushed, and was perfect. Jesus' body had not been stolen. Stand with me with Peter and John in this tomb. Stand with me and look. Whatever happened in this tomb, this body had not been stolen. Something else has happened. Something significant has happened. Something incredible has happened, but he has not been stolen. They saw and believed. They saw and believed that this was not a grave robbery. The scriptures and all the conversations that maybe Jesus had said with them, predicting his death and resurrection, had simply not sunk in at this stage. But the learning point for us this morning, in this moment, is to put yourself in Peter's shoes. Look closely at what is contained in the scriptures. Do not simply glance like Mary did. Do not simply glance like John did. But look at what is being said. The soldiers have deserted their post. The sealed tomb was broken. the tombstone was lifted and thrown. The tomb is empty. The grave wrappings are there, perfect. The only thing missing is Jesus. They looked at each other, Peter and John, in that dark tomb, and all they can think is, something has happened. Something's happened. Maybe the words of Jesus started to haunt them, as they were thinking, destroy this temple in 3 days, and I'll rebuild it. As Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the earth. But they are just not making the connections. All they can say is something incredible has happened in this tomb. Verse 10. To Mary, the tomb was a disastrous tragedy. An empty tomb was a disastrous tragedy. To Peter and John, the empty tomb and the neatly laid grave clothes, something's happened. And deep in thought, Peter and John go back to their lodgings. They're going back. Poor Mary, they left at their house. She's probably making her way back. And they're making their way back to their lodgings, deep in thought, deep in thought, deep in thought, deep in thought. What on earth has happened? What on earth has happened? Verses 11 and 12. Exit stage left, Peter and John. Exits entry stage right, Mary. Now spare a thought for Mary. She'd hurried from Jerusalem to the tomb when it was dark. Then she had run all the way back to Jerusalem to tell Peter and John. They had outrun Mary and cleared off and left her in the tracks, gone to the tomb. They have cleared off and Mary is now running back to the tomb again. She's run half a marathon already this morning. And she's now made her way back to the tomb and she's alone. And the scriptures say that Mary is crying. She's more than crying. She is sobbing. She is breaking her heart. She is wailing. She cannot control her grief right now. She is distraught with grief and confusion and a sense of absolute hopelessness. What on earth has happened? She hasn't spoken to Peter and John. And whilst venting her grief, she even stoops. That's how low the entrance is. And she looks into this tomb. And she sees two angels. One at the head and one at the foot where Jesus' body had laid. Now that is a sermon in its own right. There you go to Exodus 25. There is the formation of the Ark of the Covenant and the mercy seat, with the cherubim at head and foot. Mary somehow does not seem startled by these angels. I think I would be. And she's talking to them. Maybe their appearance is very human-like. Maybe the tomb is very dark, we know that. And her mental state, she's just so distraught. But here is a wonderful picture of grace. Just capture this. Several years earlier, Jesus had released Mary from demonic oppression. Mary had been bound by 7 demons. She must have had a terrible life that invited that type of situation, and Mary was bound by 7 demons. 7 demons. And then Jesus came into her life. And with one word, he released her. And she followed the Lord for those 2-3 years after that moment. But here we are at the garden tomb. The woman that was once oppressed by 7 demons is now comforted by 2 angels. What a transformation. Demonic activity to angelic activity in this woman's life. No wonder she's crying. She's lost the one who set her free, from all that. She's lost the one who had released her from all of that. She's lost the one who had given her hope and dignity and direction and given her humanity back. And now she stands outside an empty tomb, weeping, crying, wailing, because this is awful. That tomb should not be empty. That tomb should contain a body that I am anointing. They ask her, verse 13, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They've taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they've put him." Are you there with me in the tomb? I don't know where they've put him. I just want to find him. And verse 14, Mary, even though she is leaning into the tomb, she becomes aware that somebody else is in the garden now. Some commentators say this sounds nice, true or not. Mary's leaning in. How does she become aware that someone is behind in the garden? Some people say this. The angels would rise in the presence of Jesus. Or the angels would prostrate in the presence of Jesus. But no angel is going to be sat with arms folded when the King of Kings and Lord of Lords comes into their very presence. Mary sees something in the eyes of those angels. And she's aware that something else is happening right now. And so she turns around and looks out of the tomb from which she is been standing. Oh yes, hallelujah. She turns around and the person she is looking for is the very person who is standing before her. But she simply does not recognize him. From other scriptures we read in the resurrection accounts, it's clear that Jesus is not recognized by many. The two on the Emmaus Road, the two when they're out fishing, who's that over there? Is that he's not clearly recognizable because his appearance is somehow transformed. His appearance is somehow greater. He's familiar, but he's different. He is changed in some way. Mary lingered at the tomb to minister to Jesus in his death. But Jesus lingered at the tomb to minister to Mary in his life. Also, the last time Mary saw Jesus was during his hours of torture and crucifixion. And to use Isaiah's words, his appearance was disfigured beyond human recognition. At best, Mary was expecting, at best, a disfigured, linen-wrapped corpse, not a vibrant, living, glorified person. To Mary, the tomb, the empty tomb, is still a disastrous, terrifying nightmare. The circumstances of life had overtaken Mary, and this was her crisis of faith. For in her world, the source of her faith, the source of her hope, the source of her life had been taken from her. This person had been taken from her by others in his life. But now in his death, they have also taken him as well. The very hope of her entire being. Mary had lost all her spiritual bearings. This former demoniac was now utterly vulnerable again. The one who had set her free is dead. What's going to happen now? Her world is imploding around her. And someone's had the audacity to steal his body. Jesus had been the only person for years prior to her deliverance who had treated her with dignity and love and compassion and mercy. He treated her as a real woman, not a demon-oppressed, mad person. She was completely disorientated, Mary, at this tomb, and yet the very one she was looking for was within arm's reach. Learning point. To those who have no faith, here or listening online, or to those experiencing their own crisis of faith, I want to say this. He never went away. He never went away. He is still there. He is still at arm's length. He is still speaking to you. The question is, can you sense him? He asked her, verse 15, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Question number one. How does this stranger know that she is looking for someone? It's dawn and it's a garden. Who else would be in the garden at such an early hour but a gardener? So Mary assumes that he had moved the body of Jesus. Verse 16. And now our English Bibles do not explain it in the fullest way. Jesus now changes languages. And another question, how did this stranger know her name? He knew that she was looking for someone, and he knew her name. And Jesus now speaks in Aramaic, and he calls her by her real name, Miriam. Miriam. I think that's how he had always called her. That's how he had always referred to her, by her native tongue, Miriam. And when this grieving, disorientated, desperate woman hears the Lord call her by name, everything instantly, miraculously changed. And everything became as clear as the dawn that was approaching in the garden. It was the voice who many years earlier had released her from demon oppression. It was the voice who had called her to himself. It was a voice who had shown love and care and compassion. And the day that Jesus probably set her free from the demonic oppression, he called her by her Aramaic name, Miriam. And when she heard God and the same voice call her by name, it all dawned and became instantly clear. And she speaks back in her Aramaic, Rabboni, Rabboni, my teacher, my master. He's not dead, my friends. Look at the evidence. We've walked through scriptures. We haven't stopped anywhere. We just walked through the scriptures. Look at the evidence. He's not dead. He has arisen. And he is speaking to a woman who has a crisis of faith. No Roman authority could keep him in. No stone could keep him out. No one has taken his body. He had received from the Father an eternal, glorified body because the Father is satisfied with what his Son accomplished on the cross. Mary is rejoicing in the way that she refers to him. She goes back to her Aramaic. She calls him by Lord. She calls him a teacher. Now go back to the start of the day. To Mary, an empty tomb was a disastrous tragedy. To Peter and John, an empty tomb with neatly laid grave clothes was a mystery, but a glimmer of something that had happened. But now to Mary, the empty tomb was a place of rejoicing. The scriptures come to mind. Thou hast turned my mourning into dancing for me. The place of death became the place of life. A place of victory where, oh, death is your sting. A place of eternal hope. She could say the words of Eof. She could say the words of Job. I know that my Redeemer lives. He's met me at the tomb. I thought it was a bad day. This is a good day. Verse 17. No, Mary flings her arms around Jesus. She's lost him once. She's not going to let him go again. But Jesus' response to Mary highlights something. Verse 17. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I've not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Again, there's another fulfillment, I think, going back to the Yom Kippur, the Day of Judgment, the Day of Atonement, the role of the priest, which we can't go into, but there is another fulfillment there. But this response by Jesus has been long debated. Why is he saying to Mary, "Don't hold on to me, Mary"? When later on he says to Thomas, "Come on, put your fingers." Why does he say to Mary, "No," and to Thomas, "Yes"? Long debated. But the answer, I think, is as simple as this. Mary thinks that Jesus has just risen and he's about to ascend, so she does this. "I'm not letting you go, Lord." Mary's thinking, "This is the last moment of this side of eternity that I will see you, Lord. So I'm going to hang on to you. I'm going to make the most of this moment. I'm not going to let you go." But Jesus simply tells her, "I am about to ascend to my Father. But go and tell the disciples." But now something has changed. "Now go and tell my brothers that I am going to ascend." In other words, let me give you this, a David Dando version, okay? "Mary, I'm not going now, but I am going soon. So go and tell my brothers that I am going soon." Because we also know that in the other gospel, I say that he's going to go ahead of them into Galilee where he would meet them. Mary gets it. She realizes this isn't the last time she will see Jesus. He's given her a mission. So she will see Jesus again. So once again, with renewed energy, the woman who had hurried to Jerusalem, ran to the tomb, ran back to Jerusalem, ran back to the tomb, now runs back to Jerusalem on her fourth heat. And she's running with renewed energy, purpose, and joy. She lets Jesus go, and she races off to the disciples. In Mary's mind, it's a great day. It's a wonderful day. It's the best day that's ever been. It's the greatest day because the resurrection of Jesus authenticates his claim that he was the Son of God. His resurrection proves that the Father was satisfied with his sacrifice. He shall see of the travail of the soul and be satisfied. His resurrection provides hope to all that believe in him, that we now can call God, go back a verse, we can now call God Father because we are now brothers and sisters in him. We can experience the forgiveness of sins through his sacrifice and be adopted into the family of God. This, listeners, the word brothers, sisters, this is the first time in John's gospel that Jesus refers to the disciples as brothers. He has called them friends before, but now through his death, through his resurrection, we can now, through the resurrected power of Jesus Christ, be brought, adopted into the family of God.
Now, this is what Jesus is saying to Mary in a nutshell. If you think just Jesus is saying, just go and tell him I'm alive. He's selling far more to Mary. He said, I'm about to ascend, Mary, but go and tell the brothers, the new family of God, because I'm alive, I will be ascending back to the Father. But I'm ascending to my God and your God, to my Father and your Father. The resurrection of Jesus has brought something dramatic. And that is the fact that we are now called into the family of God through the finished work of Christ upon the cross and through the power of his resurrection. It's all contained in that word.
That's why the Hebrew writer says, I've got to finish, my time has gone. In bringing many sons and daughters to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through what he suffered. Both the one who makes people holy, that's Jesus, and those who are made holy are of the same family.
So, Jesus is not afraid to call them.
Get a little bit excited. Jesus said an awful lot to Mary that moment. In one sentence, he's saying, I'm not ashamed to call you my brothers and my sisters. I'm the pioneer, I'm the author of your faith, and I will bring many sons and daughters to glory because I'm stood outside. See that too, Mary? I came out of there. I am alive. You're hanging on to me. Go and tell the brothers quick. I'm about to ascend, but go and tell them this message, Mary. You are now in the family of God. No wonder she said, Rabboni, my master, my teacher. Wow, this was a bad day, just got really good. Listener, here online, the Christian faith is meaningless unless Jesus rose again. Listen closely to the facts. And I pay tribute to this woman, Mary, Miriam. She was of previous immoral character, possessed by demons. But Mary was the first human being to see the risen Lord. Mary was the first human being to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ, that he died and rose again. And has brought us into the family of God. Why God chose her over an apostle, over a prophet, or over a priest to deliver such a message, I will never know. If you were going to get someone to be your first preacher, who would you choose? Who would you choose? But Jesus chose Mary. Mary started a chain reaction that Easter morning 2,000 years ago in a garden tomb by proclaiming, according to the scriptures, that Jesus died and rose again. And 2,000 years later, I am simply continuing the same message because it's as true and as relevant and as necessary today as it was in that morning in Jerusalem, outside the city wall, in that place. If God entrusted this woman to proclaim this message, then women should be entrusted to do the same today. Application time. Look at the evidence from these 18 verses. Deserted soldiers, an empty tomb, grave clothes left in perfect place, angelic visitation, an eyewitness of a risen Lord, one of many who will come. The same message that has turned this world upside down. A message that the first disciples and thousands of others have died for. And it all started in a garden tomb just outside Jerusalem. To those who have no faith, Jesus offers you that salvation today. The Apostle Paul, writing to the Romans, he writes these words. If you declare with your mouth, Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Read those scriptures, not out loud, but read them again in your mind. If you declare with your mouth, Jesus is Lord. Can I get a declaration in this room this morning? Not, I'm thinking it. No, if you declare with your mouth, Jesus is Lord, and you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you shall be saved. Can I ask this question this morning? Is there someone in this room who has said that for the first time? Is there someone in this room who has believed that for the first time? You've confessed with your mouth, Jesus is Lord, and you believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead. Then I say to you this morning, with such a work of the Spirit in your life, you will be saved. You will be saved. And for any who are listening, who are experiencing their crisis of faith, I want to say he never went away. He is still with you. He is still speaking to you in the same way he spoke to Mary that morning. She just couldn't see him through her tears, through her hurt, and through her circumstances. But if you're in your crisis of faith this morning, just listen. Maybe he is speaking to you right now. He never went away. Lo, Jesus meets us. Risen from the tomb, lovingly he greets us, scatters fear and gloom. Let the church with gladness hymns of triumph sing, for her Lord now liveth, death has lost its sting. Thine be the glory, risen, conquering Son, endless is the victory, thou, all death has won.